Looking for a better way to connect to your Kickstarter audience? Looking for videos to reach out and inform your followers what exactly is going on, fulfilling campaigns, or, you know, just creating content to interact with audience? I'm your guy. If you're an author looking to make something a dynamic video to reach out and actually reach your Kickstarter followers, whether it's offering a cool reward, whether it's answering mail, whether it's whatever you can imagine, I can be there to help you. Check out my Kickstarter services in the description below. Welcome, fellow patrons, to this Patreon edition of Just Joshing. This will be eventually live on the regular show as well, but this was my guest, Stuart Bentley. It was kind of fun. I met him at a party. I was invited by a friend I did not see at the party. It was kind of weird. Stuart was a really, really swell guy. We had a really wonderful, fun conversation, and we did it here in Calgary. So here, without further ado, let's get into the conversation. And thank you, everybody, for listening to this very special audio-only episode. I couldn't quite get him filmed. I tried, but that didn't quite happen. So, yeah. But we still had a really fun conversation about everything. Star Trek, his work, his shows, how he got in at a later age, and just figuring out how to do things on his own, which was, I think, really cool. All right, enough preamble from me. Let's get into the conversation, shall we?
There we go.
Sometimes it's the simple things that make this work.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So how you doing, Stu?
Doing good. Yeah, it's been a busy last few months. So.
Yeah. So for everyone wondering, I met Stuart actually at a Christmas party that the person that invited me didn't exactly show up. She kind of did, but I never saw her. That was kind of strange, right? And then it was like, well, so I kind of made a decision at that I'm not going to do anything with her ever again. But good things do come from opportunities, right? So
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So you've been busy doing what?
Oh, geez. Well, lots of audiobook narration in whatever time I can stay at home with. Throughout the November-December period, I was doing a lot of Santa Claus appearances. And then at the same time I was doing that, I was rehearsing for a play called Sylvia. We just closed on Saturday after a three-weekend run. And then Sunday morning, I moved back into the same theater with a different theater company for the next play I'm in.
Nice.
So I'll be living there till the 17th of February.
That's your winter home then?
It seems like it. Yeah. 6 weeks in a row in the pump house.
That's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. So, as for me, it's actually done the opposite. I lost everything in November. Like, November was kind of a rough, like all my contracts were frozen solid. I lost the big one, and it was just like, it's the life of the game, right? So, there's ups, there's downs, there's lefts, there's rights, and you just got to kind of ride the wave with it, right? And that's just the way it works. I mean, making a living as an artist is not for the faint of heart.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. It requires a certain degree of, this is going to go off the rails at some point a little bit, right? Because it's part of the ride, right? Right. So you just got to learn. It's like, okay. But for me personally, I'm currently, because I'm getting ready to, I want to be kind of traveling by the time springtime hits. So.
That'll be nice. Where do you plan to go?
For now, it's going to depend on a couple things. Like, I do have some things that are going to be starting up in the spring, like, for sure, right? And so those things are going to play some roles. But the other thing, too, is I'm trying to replace my side gig, right? I can actually say it, like, my day job's a side gig now.
Yeah.
Right? I'm trying to replace my side gig with something much more remote and creative. Because the moment I have that, I can go.
Right.
Right, and I can just go. And I mean, I might still be tied to a part of the country, but I can now, okay, so I want to go to San Diego for a month from July to August because there's two big conventions. I did one last year, so I want to do that. I want to possibly go to Hawaii at the end of the year. And in the middle, like, just travel. I kind of hit that point in my life where, I don't know if you've experienced this, where I came back here to kind of reconnect with people, but the one thing I've noticed about the city this time around is a lot of people are very reluctant to connect with people. They're a lot more reluctant. And a lot of the people I knew as friends, I mean, I've been here 2 years and I still haven't seen some of them.
Yeah. The COVID had a real chilling effect on a lot of relationships and a lot of people's willingness to go out and be out and about just doing things a lot.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how much of a hangover there still is in a lot of areas.
Well, especially here, like comparing San Diego, because I was there last year, like this isn't like this, ignoring the convention, which I recommend everybody goes. I had more human interaction in San Diego in a week than I've had here in a year.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, some places are definitely harder than others. Right. Right. So what I realized, like the pandemic did the opposite thing with me, which is because I've faced my mortality before. So like, because I had my own little brush with my own, hey, one day I'm going to die and do this shit. What matters to you? You can't be afraid of the world, because the world has not changed.
Oh no. No, it's been an interesting ride, and I mean, outside of, you know, dire health effects for a lot of people, and I've got friends that are dealing with severe ongoing long COVID problems that they may never recover from. Aside from all of that, it actually had one very positive effect for me. At the time, I still had a day job that I didn't like, but I was also my wife's caregiver at the time for her dementia. And when they sent me to work from home, suddenly that meant I was able to be there for her 24 hours a day. And she was able to stay with us in the home for probably at least a year, if not 14 or 15 months longer than she would have before going into care. So that was a huge positive for me. I will always take it as
no,
that.
No, you know what? I understand. My grandfather, my last... I didn't see it to the full extent my grandmother did, but my grandfather, like towards the end of his life, was going through his own dementia. And it was, I remember my last conversation with him specifically, because this is when I knew, like he knew too. I think we just both knew. We were having a good time. We were talking and I sound like my dad. So he called me Tony, which is my dad's name. But it was a moment of like, he knew, like all of a sudden he became lucid again. And it was just like, oh wait, this isn't Tony. This is, and it rattled him. It rattled me a little bit too, because it's looking at your significant, like your people you love, as vulnerable. And I always will have sympathy for people that because of people who have to take care of with dementia or anything like that. Yep. I always will have sympathy, because it's an incredibly hard thing to do.
Yeah.
I do not say that lightly. Like, you're taking care of another person and watching them change.
Oh yeah, they're just slowly going away.
Yeah.
And I mean, the type of dementia that my wife Laura has is you know, and I didn't really know about it until her father got it, and it's not genetic. It's just a fluke that she got it as well. It's called Lewy body dementia. It's what Robin Williams had.
Okay.
And you don't forget people, but you become more and more childlike. You lose the ability to make reason. Your body stops monitoring its blood pressure properly, and that'll go up and down crazily. You can't move properly. It's usually misdiagnosed as Parkinson's disease, because it looks like Parkinson's early on.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I mean, the lucid periods just got shorter and shorter and further apart.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've really seen a lucid moment now in over a year.
My condolences. I'm just saying like that. I really, there's just not much I can offer you. But
and not looking for it, but thank you. I really appreciate that. It's one of those things. We're all going to go through something. We all experience, you know, exposure to... disease, death, you know, bankruptcy, whatever it might be, things that are terribly hurtful. Somebody, your parents' house burns down. You don't know what it's going to be. Car accidents. But, you know, you have to deal with whatever life hands you as best you can.
Oh, no, absolutely. The one thing I learned about life is that you're not walking away from it. Something is going to take you out. So you can look at it one of two ways. You can look at it like, oh my God, everything, I'm going to protect myself from everything to the best of my ability. Which ultimately, like, there are some things I recommend, like healthy diet, like taking care of yourself, sure. But there comes a point where you just, there's no way, it's impossible. Like, the world is a dangerous place just going outside.
Yeah. It opened my eyes to a lot of things. I mean, I've been acting in some form since I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So, 66 now, do the math, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And I really got to the point... after my wife went into care, that I went, you know what, I don't think I can do the 9 to 5 to pay my bills while I pursue my passion on the side anymore. In fact, it was killing me to do that. So I walked away and said, I'm just going to jump off the cliff. I'm going to flap my arms as hard as I can.
Yep.
And I'll pay the bills as I can, and I'll make things work. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's been over a year and a half now since I made that leap. And I'm surviving. I'm getting enough work between audiobooks and the odd bit of film work or voice work that it's doing what it needs to do, and I'm happier than I've been in a long, long time.
No, it's so liberating. Like, the one thing I will say, like, doing what I'm doing, like, I'm trying to turn this into a living.
Sure.
Like, right, that's the journey, right? And it's interesting to watch, because what's happened is, right, I'm freer. Like it was really strange. I was putting together this, like, my Patreon last night, and my podcast course I'm doing, right, just as a side thing, right? And I'm putting this stuff together, and I'm like, what am I doing? But on the other hand, it's like, who's doing? Like, that's a really cool... I get the opportunity to meet amazing people, and I don't ever take that for granted. I get to go to cool places. I'm trying to create, kind of, while I'm still in Calgary, a bit of that travel experience. So, folks, this is why. Now, sometimes it's not going to work out the way I planned, but I always plan for a backup anyway. Like, that's the one thing I've learned. But it's fun. And life can be fun, even as crazy a time as this is right now.
For sure.
Like, it's what you make of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Figure out what's most important to you and go do it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. For me, I would make a million mistakes. And I'm good with that. I'm trying to keep my regrets to under two hands. That's my legitimately my goal in my life. It's not if I don't need to make it to every single thing on my bucket list. I don't feel like that's not a regret. If I'm trying everything, I can live with that. It's that when I'm afraid to do something, then I know I have to do it. No. You're like, I'm not there, but that's me, right? And I'm cool with that.
I had one of my mentors years ago when I mentioned that I had chosen to move from Edmonton up to Yellowknife, and it meant walking away from a film agent that I had at the time. It meant I was taking a completely different course for a few years, and I mentioned to this, and she was one of my acting mentors, I meant to mention that I almost regretted making the decision, and I don't know how it's going to work out. And she says, no, don't regret anything. Every single thing you do in your life builds who you are. And mm-hmm. don't look to your past and say, if I would have done this then, no, you'd have been a different person, and you wouldn't have had what built you to who you are today. So she says, yeah, don't regret. Regrets, you know, if you've made mistakes and you can learn by them, but don't regret, because it built you to who you are.
No. I agree with that, but I look at it kind of like, there's two things. Like, there's a couple things in my life that I wish I had done. This was me as a younger man not knowing this stuff, right?
Oh, sure.
Right? And we all make those mistakes. I think that pain was good, because it made me realize, like, that's not the kind of pain I want in my life, right? And that's, I think that's a very honest thing, like,
oh, sure.
Right? And I'm not, like, I'm happy with who I am and all that stuff, but I'm like, you know, I just learned, like, I learned at a very young age, it's what you, like, it's the things you feel inside that you feel called to do,
yeah.
Right? Those are the things you need to do. Like, those are the things that, you, like, I feel you should do, because they're there for a reason, right? I have this weird belief that I don't think dreams are really dreams. I think they're just possibilities, and you can actually manifest them to make them real.
They can. They're so weird, and I don't know an actor that hasn't had the dream where they step out on stage and they don't know the lines for the show they're in, and
yes.
Everybody else does. Every actor. Last week, before our Thursday night show, I'd had a really late night, and I was having a nap in the afternoon, and I woke up from the nap. I had a dream that I'd gone to Edmonton to see old friends. And we'd gone golfing, and then we were in, like, the pub afterwards. We're chatting, and one of my friends said, how come you never tell us about the shows you're in anymore? And I go, well, I'm in a show right now. I've been posting about it on Facebook for weeks. And as a matter of fact, we got a show this Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And I went, wait a minute. today's Thursday. What time is it? It's 6:20. I've got a show at 7:30. No. And I was freaking out because how am I going to get to Edmonton, to Calgary in an hour and 10 minutes for a show? And I woke up just in a sweat.
Does your body's internal alarm clock going, you got a show to get you.
Oh, man. Yeah. Try to go back to sleep, continue the nap. Wasn't happening.
Yeah, I know. That's fair enough. Fair enough. No. But, it's an interesting thing, right? The human psychology is interesting. I've had dreams like that as a writer, right? Just like, and it's like you got a place you got to be. It's like, what do you mean I got a place I got to be? What? And you wake up, you're like, oh no, I got hours left to go. But you're so amped up for what you're doing, right? And that's good. You're excited about what you're doing, and I think that's probably the best fountain of youth I could even have.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been really interested in. Recently, I started reading, listening to, because I mostly listen to books now.
Okay.
I still love to read, but I find I have so much free time when I'm driving or doing housework or yard work that I'll just throw my earbuds in and I'm listening to books. Well, if it's in the car, it's not earbuds, it's through the Bluetooth. Yeah. But I found a book series by an author named Sean Inman called The Middle Falls Time Travel Series. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible. Every single book is about a different person. Probably from the Middle Falls area, which is a fictional town in Oregon. And at some point in their lives, they die. And then they wake up at an earlier point in their life with all of their memories intact. And sometimes they try to make their life better, or sometimes they recycle through their lives multiple times before they find the right track for them and everything sort of falls into place. And you know, there's a lovely group on Facebook of people that are fans of the series. And, you know, they're often talked about, well, if you woke up in your life again at some earlier point, you know, what would be your restart point? Where would you like to go back to? And what would you change in your life? And it's interesting. I mean, it's just an exercise, obviously. But the novels are so well written and they're very human.
Yeah.
You know, they really hit you in your heart very hard. And the characters are all unique and engaging. So stuff like that, I love listening to books like that, and I love narrating books that grab your attention and you know is going to hold a reader's attention or listener's attention. I love bringing stories to life, and nonfiction.
Yeah.
Nonfiction is fun to bring to life too.
Nonfiction is actually, so I do educational stuff on when I produce.
Right.
Right? It's fun. It's you wouldn't think it, but the challenge of, so even if it's dry stuff, the challenge of, okay, how can I make this interesting?
Yeah.
Is actually, and nonfiction can be really interesting, depending on the field and stuff like that. I mean, it's true what they say, truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
And people are always, like to me personally, people are always fascinating, like nonfiction wise, they're always fascinating. I like certain sciences. I really love listening to myself, but again, everybody has their own interest. But nonfiction can be—it's underrated how entertaining it actually can be.
Well, and nonfiction covers such a wide range. It could be life stories, biographies, autobiographies. It could be the story of a company. It could be business books, how-to books, or you know, stories about medicine or diet. You name it. There's so many things it can be. I just completed one last week that's now live that's called The Chief Executive Operating System, and it's how to properly be a CEO and how to build your company and your executives below you so that they all follow the same methods and to make your company more successful. It's by a famous CEO by the name of Joel Trammell and his partner Sharif Sakher, and it's a tremendous book, and I learned so much just reading it. And they offer services where they go right into companies and help you build your processes. And it was a joy to do their book.
Yeah, and following through on a vision is like as a CEO, like someone like we're kind of self-employed, so we don't have the same big giant structure, but the idea of having a vision and following through on it applies so much to big companies, big time. And so I could see the appeal. For sure.
Yeah, and CEOs almost all have a board to answer to, but they're still the one responsible, and when it comes down to it, you have to understand people at all levels and understand what makes different people motivated and what rewards work for different people.
Yep.
And how to make sure every part of your business works. That's what the whole gist of this book was. It was lovely to work on.
Yeah, no, that sounds fun.
And one that came out last year that I did that I'm going to go back and listen to it again just because I enjoyed the story so much. I don't want to listen to me, but I want to hear the story. And I loved narrating. It was about a young man growing up in the early 60s and in a kind of a broken household in a small town with some toxic religion happening and his confusion around all of that and trying to find out who he was. Vietnam War is going on and, you know, the hippie movement is just starting.
Yeah.
And it's called Remembering Stardust. And it's so good. It's such a good book.
Yeah. So do you get that weird thing? Because I get this, even though I've done thousands of these.
Yeah.
I can actually say I've done thousands of these. That's weird.
there you go.
Yeah. But that's something that's going to hold. It's like, but the thing is, I never get used to my voice.
Because
It's never quite what I imagined it would be. Right? Like, what I hear here and what I hear on this are just slightly different, right?
And sure, you don't have the same resonance, the bones in your head and everything that make, you know, you think what your voice sounds like. And you hear it back on microphone and out of speakers, it's not the same.
Yeah, it's not even remotely. And you're like, it always jars me a little bit, right? Mm. So
it used to do that for me years ago. I'm so far past that now. I actually, what I hear back to me sounds pretty much the same now. But
yeah,
it's just, you get used to it, I guess. And so my brain's gone, oh, that's you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's fair. No, it's just, I always wonder, like, there's always a little, I mean, obviously I'm not like as perturbed about it as when I started, but I still hear it when I first, it's like, yeah, it will never, ever not feel this way, right? So, but no, it's awesome. What do you prefer, fiction or nonfiction?
Boy, yes. I really enjoy good fiction. One of the ones that I did last year, and the author is extending it, and it was a novella about a 3-hour piece about a man with ALS who's locked in. He can't move anymore. He can't speak. Can't advocate for himself anymore. And his only means of communication is with an eye tracker device, and so he can communicate through his computer by moving his eye and spelling sentences out one letter at a time. The author is in that position, and he wrote the entire book that way.
Oh, wow.
And so now he's finishing it, and he's expanding it. And it was a fictional account of his experiences living with his disease and long-term care and the good and the bad of long-term care. Now, my wife's in long-term care, so I identified very strongly with this one. And
no, it's fair.
Yeah, so I'm very much looking forward to completing it now that he's extended it to the point that he's saying it's going to be a completed work.
No, that's fair. I understand the connection. I have a belief, and I think it's true with acting, with writing, with all that stuff. We all attach to things that matter to us the most.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And our best work, when we do produce it, comes from a real place inside us.
Yep.
Right? I think that's the real secret. It took me about 15 years to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah, my two favorite stage roles, one's a fiction, one's a nonfiction.
Yeah.
Frost Nixon, about the Frost Nixon interviews. Mm-hmm. I got the opportunity 10 years ago to play Richard Nixon in that. And it was a phenomenal play. It's extremely well written. It was then made into a movie. But the play is extremely well written. And the production just sank. And I wanted to know what made Richard Nixon tick. What took him from being a young man growing up, you know, in a poor community to, you know, this sort of Quaker upbringing and his mom caring for sick people, losing his brother earlier disease. What made him the bitter, paranoid person that he became? And so it was very interesting to understand that, because from inside Nixon's head, he was the hero of the story.
Sure.
Of course.
We all are the hero. Like,
yeah.
It takes a certain self-awareness to come to the point that, like, sometimes we're the villain.
Yeah.
Right? And not everybody learns this.
Yeah, well, I mean, as Nixon famously said to David Frost, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
So, you know, there is a truth to that. But, I mean, But I think the thing that really makes things, wakes bad people or quote unquote bad people, I'm going to put that in quotation marks because I never met the guy. Never know. Like, of course. Right? But the thing is, if you want, look at most people's motivations, it doesn't matter really what level of life you have. They're very human motivations, right?
They're not unfathomable.
No.
You can see what brought a person to where they are.
Yeah.
Life does that.
Yeah. No, like in Nixon's case, if I were to guess, just based on what I do know about him, right? It was a combination of what he went through when he was younger, the drive to achieve things. And I think that once he got it, he feared losing it.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, he went to a poor law school.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't have all the advantages. And mm-hmm. as he got into, you know, and he was a very good lawyer. And when he got into practice, he resented the rich kids that went to the Harvards. And, you know, and he really looked down on them because he thought they looked down on him. So he resented them fiercely. And that's just sort of, it festered and it just kept. It informed his life,
yes,
in so many ways. And yeah, is there personality flaws there? Is there what? Yeah, I'm sure. But it's who he was. And
oh yeah, I mean, yeah. One thing we get, we're like, none of us are perfect, and all our roads lead like this thing. None of us are perfect. All our roads lead somewhere, and like I said, we kind of choose it. We kind of choose where we end up. Right? Sometimes fate can throw whatever dice it throws its way, but what it comes right down to is how we view the world.
Yeah.
And once you realize that, it's like, okay, what do you want in it?
Yeah.
All right? And it's a very, how do I put this? It's our power. Like, that's actually, I think, It's what makes us powerful, but it's also our flaw, because we can put anything, we can make our world whatever we want it to be.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing in some ways, because it allows us to overcome a lot of things.
Yeah.
But it also can blind us to what we're doing.
Yeah. So on the fiction side, I was really fortunate enough, after 25 years of wanting to see a certain play produced, I'm on the board of Scorpio Theater right now, and we decided, well, I put it forward to, I think, their third different artistic director, that we do the play Sylvia by A.R. Gurney, phenomenal, very prolific playwright who passed just a few years ago. And Sylvia's about a man in his late middle age, whose kids have gone off to college, and his wife now has a new successful career. He's unhappy in his career, he's kind of lost in his life. And he finds a stray dog in the park and brings it home. And he's fallen in love with this stray dog, Sylvia. And his wife wants nothing to do with this dog. And the marriage sort of goes astray as he has this love for this dog. And eventually it all sort of comes full circle and everything works in the end. But the honesty in the writing for how all of these characters get along. And it's an incredible comedy. And yet at the end of the show, every night, the audience was coming up to me, oh my God, you made me cry.
Yeah.
It was so heartfelt and touching, because it's that as well. And I think the best plays, the best comedies have lots of pathos in them too. And they have that solid, grounded human moment. You're not going to see that in a farce.
No.
Farce is fun. Farce is just, let's slam doors and the cat's on fire and, oh my God, I got a sack of money I have to hide and I hope they don't find the strippers in the closet.
Yeah, it will. Well, farce is designed to be, like, if I were to put it this way, farce is designed to be like cotton candy. It's fun.
Oh, yeah.
But you shouldn't devour all of it. Good comedy. One of my favorite comedians, my favorite for writing, Terry Pratchett.
Oh.
Have you ever read? Have you ever,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So my personal favorite of his is, I think it's Sorcery Eric.
Yeah.
It wasn't the humor. It was the point he made. And that really stuck home. Feet of Clay is also one of my favorites for this reason too. So the dragon wins in Eric. And people were starting to sacrifice their people to the dragon. And this wasn't fine. This was a serious moment in the book. And the most profound thing he said in that moment was, if people are afraid, they will do terrible things to each other.
Yeah.
And that was a very, like, during the pandemic, especially,
yep.
I saw that firsthand. And I'll never forget that for as long as I live. That was comedy at its best. It makes us look at really profound, sometimes disturbing things about the world, and gives us the ability to laugh about it in a good way. I think, yeah. Right? It allows us to deal and move forward. And I think good comedy makes us think, makes us feel things other than the laughter, but it also does make us laugh as well, because it's how we,
for sure,
it's how we move forward. And those are the best comedies.
Yeah, all good writing should make you see things within yourself.
Yeah,
you know, or the people you know. The identification factor. I know that.
Yeah.
You mentioned Terry Pratchett. One of the plays that we were going to do with Scorpio a couple of years ago, and it was actually in rehearsals, and then one after the other, different cast members were getting COVID because it was the return. It was that third wave, that Omicron wave, and we ended up having to shut the production down. We didn't do another show for a couple of years, and that was what we just closed. We're looking to do that play, and it's Guards, Guards, which is based on Terry Pratchett's book.
And that's a good one.
It's funny. The characters are hilarious.
Ankh Morpork, like the Night Watch. The Night Watch legitimately are my favorite character. So Rincewind is, I always tell people start with him only because if you read any of the others first, you can't enjoy that one at all, because he's such a one-line joke. Like, but again, it was his first one, so you understand it. Like, then you get to Granny Weatherwax or Mort or The Watch or any of the other characters he focuses on, and they're so much more complex and they're so much more fun they could do. That, like, later on in the series, like later on in this world, Rincewind becomes more of a side character and not so much a main character. But that's why, compared to everything else, like, he's very one dimensional. And so I just like, so read Rincewind first because you'll enjoy him for what he is, and then read everybody else, because otherwise you're going to be very disappointed when you read Rincewind, right? All right. And that's a personal approach to Terry Pratchett. You can take my, you don't have to take my word for it, but you'll see what I mean, right? And Stuart's nodding his head, so he gets where I'm coming from there.
100%.
Yeah, but no, like, good comedy. Like, the thing is, when I look at comedians today, like, I look at, like, guys like Dave Chappelle, whatever you might think of him, makes you think, right? Guys like, you know, guys like Chris Rock, whatever you think of him, makes you think, right? Or George Carlin, classically, is one of my favorite comedians. As I get older, I appreciate him more.
Yeah, I grew up listening to my dad's Lenny Bruce records.
Yeah.
You know, so listening to the sick humor of Lenny Bruce and the non-Sketo Airlines skit and, you know, Hitler as a painter, you know, in the casting agent's office, you know, outrageous ways of looking at things. He was a brilliant, brilliant comedian who, as his life got harder and he felt persecuted, his shows became more rants, where he talked more just about his life, but they were still fascinating to listen to, because they all came from a very strong point of view.
Also, the truth's hilarious.
Yeah.
No, like, honestly, the truth is absolutely hilarious. If you're very honest with somebody, they will almost laugh.
Yeah.
In response, because it's almost like that unbelievable. It's both unbelievable and cathartic at the same time.
Oh yeah. Well, and George Carlin was a master of that. He would hold up life and show you the absurdity of things, and like the hypocrisy, mm-hmm. and like his way of delivering that to you was undeniably hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, it was like you'd cringe because, yeah, that's true. That's what life is, and oh my God, we're doing that still.
It's funny because I'm looking at. And I don't want to go into too much doom and gloom. I'm watching, like, I can see that we're coming towards another big change, because we have to, because yeah. we're at that point where we've all quietly, whether we realized it or not, have realized that this, as we currently are doing things, is unsustainable. I can only imagine what it's going to be like in a couple of years. And what comes from that is going to be the question going forward. And I look at that. I am the eternal optimist. I kind of feel like I feel the end goal, no matter what, is going to be the same thing. It's how we get there is going to be the magical question.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty positive about the long-term view of it. I know we're already going through a lot of pain because of it, and it's likely going to get worse.
Yeah.
But it's like the onset of the Industrial Revolution and how that changed how people worked, and work sucked, and it got harder, and children working in smoke-filled factories and all. Yeah, we still have child labor today, and that's appalling. And in some places, in the United States, so many of the people that are picking fruit are children.
Yes.
Fruit and vegetables. It's disgusting. And the hours they're working and the dangerous conditions they work under. We're also going through the information and technology revolution right now, where we're seeing more and more jobs automated and taken away from people. And all the money is just going into, 12 people's pockets so that they can hoard it like giant dragons. And that's, we got to rethink how we support the population and allow people to create.
Yeah.
I think we are on the verge of perhaps a period when people can be as creative as possible, but we have to get past this hoarder mentality that's been going on for a long time now.
Well, we talk about human nature. So this is, we had about 100 years ago, a lot of people, World War II is a fascinating period, but to me, the more fascinating period was the 30s. Because the 30s was an incredible decade of invention. If the war hadn't happened, it's very likely there would have been a renaissance in the 30s. Right? Just some Tesla, Royal Reimer, Ford. There was a lot of brilliant Einstein. There's a lot of brilliant, even before World War II.
Sure, oh yeah.
Right? There was a lot of brilliant things going on in the 1930s. And the reason why I bring it up is we kind of come back to full circle. Information is readily available at our fingertips. It is possible now. You are living proof of this. I'm coming to the point of being living proof of this. You don't need the system as we know it to make a living anymore. And that's an incredibly powerful thing. So more and more people, as time goes on, I think are going to go that direction. Now, the question to me is this. Okay, we have a very old, antiquated system. Are people going to continue to play the "I like my political candidate better than you" game and think that's politics? Or are we actually legitimately going to talk about real issues? And different. That's, I think, a very different thing.
Yeah, we started going from having good discourse politically through most of history. Let's talk about most of the last 20, 30. The mid-century was probably as good as it got in whatever way. But starting in the 80s, it started to become more and more and more a tribal thing. Your side versus my side.
Yeah.
And no matter what, you're wrong and evil. And this horrid polarization that has been not good for anybody and has created a lot of violence.
Yeah.
And that, I believe, will end. But I don't know that it's going to be anytime really soon, because we're still seeing it spreading from...
So
it's here in Alberta, and it makes me sick at heart.
Do you want to hear my theory about it? Here's my theory. I think what's happened is... All right, and this is going to sound like maybe simplistic, but I think what's happened is politicians have lied to us too much. And the reason I say it like that is this. You wouldn't have so much of a divide if you had a clear standard of what was, if you had a clear, transparent standard of what was going on, because you wouldn't have as much, because what would happen is you'd have a standard to go by. And I think what's happened is time has gone on is, I don't really care what party you support. They're all, they all have shown signs of corruption. They've all been on trial. Heck, Trudeau was just convicted of something he did with the truckers convoy. So, I mean, whatever you think about the convoy, it shows you, again, from an ethical, legal, moral standpoint, there has been failures at the very highest of levels. And again, it's not just Trudeau.
It's all of them. Stephen Harper, Jean Chrétien, you name it. They've all had their huge failings.
Yeah. So what's happened is, I think we've hit a point where nobody honestly trusts anything anymore. And on one hand, you can't blame them. Why would you? the flip side, but here's the consequence. We all on some level need something bigger than ourselves to look into. So what tends to happen is you'll look at a party, a person, something that you identify with, and you will align yourself with it because it's close enough to your values, whatever they might be. You're kind of smiling at me evilly because it makes sense, right? It makes sense. So what happens is, okay, I call myself politically an atheist. That's not actually true. I'm politically a moderate. There are things on both sides of the equation I value. I value free speech. I value good healthcare. I value good education. I value the right to defend yourself. Again, I have a bit of a, again, my family is also American, so I have a slightly different point of view than maybe the average Canadian. But either way, there are things you can talk me in on either side of the spectrum that I'd be for. Now, I don't, again, we may not fully agree with everything, but we don't have to, right? Right. Yeah,
I call myself a democratic socialist because I believe companies, free enterprise and companies, the ability to go and invent things and run industries is just fine. But there has to be solid controls on them, both, for safety, for labor controls, for environment. And I think the biggest disservice we've seen in the last long, long while is this 30-year string of let's deregulate this, let's deregulate that, let's deregulate this, more and more and more. Oh, they'll take care of it themselves. And now we have planes with screws falling out of them left and right and doors blowing because nobody's taking care of it.
And it's every industry, too. Because what's happened there is, also just the other aspect of it, government, business, and to a lesser extent, the media, although here, government controls the media by default, but in the United States, you see it very clearly. They're merging. They have merged. And it's a bad idea to have corporate and government interests together. But
it's a bad idea to have media all controlled by one or two people.
Yeah.
Journalism should be independent. There should be more deep, caring, investigative journalism that we used to see. Newspapers used to be independently owned. Thought was very critical. People really looked at issues and you'd do a lot better reading newspapers 40, 50 years ago than you possibly can get out of any media today because they're all controlled by a couple of conglomerates.
So if I want honest journalism today, I go to Substack. Or believe it or not, X Twitter, right? Because you can actually get things there. But you have to look.
Too many fascists there for me. I will never go back to X.
No. It's fair. I get where you're saying, but it is the only spot where you can follow a story without a filter. Right? And that's, again, good, bad, or indifferent. It is what it is, right? So that's what we got. And that's, so when you look, again, going back to what I'm saying, No one knows what's true anymore. So everybody, and then the natural inclination at that point is we go to what we identify with the most. And then on top, and then what happens is there's no discourse. So now we're focused on our party, our tribe, instead of the issues that we need to really deal with. That's my crazy theory.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Something I'd like to share with you that has somewhat my mantra for life is it's how I live when I do my work as Santa Claus, and it's how I try to live every day. I came into being Santa by accident like 10 years ago, and I've never looked back. I will never look back. It's the most joy I have in my life at most moments. When I have a chance to talk to the kids that come through the line, or if I'm at a house party where I have more time to talk to people, I will always, remind them, whatever you do, please always be kind. Mm-hmm. And when I have a chance to, do more than just say, remember to be kind, I'll ask little kids, what do you think is the most important thing to do in your life? And I'll tell them, always be kind. And I said, but we'll always make mistakes. All of us get angry or we do things that we don't think about. And later on, we'll realize we were unkind to somebody. We hurt them. I says, when we do that, we have to own up to it. We have to go to that person and say, I'm sorry. What I said or what I did wasn't kind. I'm going to try to do better. And will you please forgive me? And if we could all live that way, God knows there's so many people that just don't. But I think that's one of the most important things. That's my golden rule, is just try to be kind to everybody, because you never know what road anyone's living on. And you don't know what thoughtless words or actions will have as far as deep, deep effects on other people. And we have way too much of a society that is based on just the opposite of kindness. Look at Trumpism and all of the horrible, just negative crap that we see coming out of politicians and corporate people and people with bullhorns on the street. It's shocking to me how cruel and mean so many people have become.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I actually, like, honestly, like, one of the reasons I'm traveling is I'm trying to find a kinder place. And I think the honest...
There you go.
Well,
Make wherever you are kinder. Do your best. That's what all of us can do.
No,
that's what all of us have to do.
I agree. I agree. But I'm taking it a step further. Like, this, again, going back to the very beginning,
yeah.
We're not going to make it out of here. right? We're not going to make it out
of here.
Right? But, so I got to make a decision of what's going to make me happy? Or what at least will give me a chance? Like, for the things I want in this life, what things I want to do in this life. And what I realized is, like, when I came back here, I said this earlier, like, there's some people I haven't seen, like, partly because, yes, of all life stuff, but I just realized I only have so much time and I can't wait for people, right? So I gotta go find whatever that tribe looks like for me. I gotta go find it wherever it is.
We do have to find our own happiness in life, and it's like, it's nice to think that we could do something that will have an effect that's ongoing and lasting. And I think really the only thing we can do is, and not everybody has children, and not everyone should have children. If you don't want to, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
You can have effects on the world in so many other ways. I've got three kids, my two daughters and my son, and I look at how they are a reflection of what my wife and I did and tried to live. And I'm so proud of the way they are living and influencing the friends and people around them, that I think that's the best we can hope for, is to influence as many people for good in and around us, and at the same time try to find happiness, try to find somewhere that allows us to have peace in our lives. And, you know, it's simple, I guess.
Sure.
But that's... I can't go further than that. I'm not the guy that's going to go run for government and try to change the world that way. My view is a little narrower. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
And my larger view is I love acting so much, and I love entertaining in whatever form it is, whether it's on book or in film, television or on stage, that I hope that I am spreading joy and entertainment that way, and people will be able to be influenced. I might only be one small character in something. I might be a lead character in something. And it doesn't matter. It's being part of something that people enjoy and talk about. And you know, it's interesting. In the hardest times, you talked about the 30s. In the Depression, entertainment, the film industry exploded even more so. People look for escape. People want entertainment. They want to be uplifted when life is hard. So let's. That's what I'm trying to do.
One of my favorite authors of all time is C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And the thing is, so again, whatever you might think of it, Mere Christianity is an amazing book for one very simple reason. It's when he did it. He didn't do it when things were good. He did it right in the heart when Mormon was being bombed.
Yeah.
Right? And that, anyway, actually when the pandemic first happened, I was literally one of the first people. I put my novel up as an audiobook at the very beginning, and it's clunky and it's full of mistakes, and I do it, but that wasn't the point. The point was, I realized, I think the most important thing about whatever time you're in is, for what you do and for what I do, to lesser, you're trying to make a connection with people. That is the ultimate goal, because if I connect with you, what we understand is, no matter what we may think or believe, whatever, yeah, we're not that different. And honestly, that reminder is so, I think, more important today than it's ever been.
People around the world all want those same things for their families and
yeah,
their friends. The play that I just was in, Sylvia, our title actor in the show, Snezhana, moved here from Ukraine with her husband and son. And, you know, she's playing a dog, and it's very human, and you get to see the honesty of life through the eyes of a dog, who, and this, you know, our dog is very prescient and very smart, but the dog holds a mirror up to these people in many ways. But, you know, just hearing her talk and the way she cares for her husband and her son, and she worries about her friends back home, and everyone I've met from Africa, from South America, that I've worked with from anywhere, they all have that same thing. People that are stuck in camps below the southern border in the United States, they all want the same thing. They want safety and peace and health for their families. And that's all we want. That's all any of us really want.
Most of us just want to live our lives, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, good for our family. And for the most part, be left alone from that, right? I mean, that's what most of us want.
Yep.
It's not a hard thing to understand. I think, so like I said, I think we're going to end up in a happier place. I do think we're going to go through a time, because I think we have to, I think at some point we have to come face to face with our problems. And when we do, that's going to be when things change. But in the meantime, I mean, yeah, you change the world little by little, and that can be being a Santa at a mall. That could be being an actor in Sylvia on a play. That could be me making an ass of myself on a microphone right now.
It could be a politician who has a dream. It can be a preacher who has a dream. It can be a talk show on a television, you know, broadcast. There are people who are really trying to bring enlightenment to the world, and that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And I think we are heading towards another really great enlightenment.
Yeah.
I see it more and more and more. I see the foothold of the angry, really, like I say, fascist, that might be a little off, but the really awful side of humanity I see is getting a little louder, but I also think it's getting a little narrower and a little smaller. And I think we are on the verge of a better breakthrough in life.
Yeah, I do too. I it'll be interesting to see what happens when we do. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
Right? I'm hopeful, and that's all we can be.
I have to be. I can't live any other way. Well, I have to be hopeful.
Yeah. I have one last question, and then we can call it an interview.
Sure.
I've enjoyed this. I hope you have too.
Yeah.
How did you get into acting? Wow.
Yeah. It's great. No, yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
This is a fun story, and how I got in and then how I became serious about it are sort of connected. So I grew up in Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started junior high school, grade 7, I had passed music tests in elementary school. And I said, yeah, you qualify to be in the band. You can hear notes and whatever. So I ended up being in the band, and I played French horn. And so my electives that year were choral singing and band.
Okay.
And I loved it.
Sure.
I really enjoyed it. I was getting quite good at it. Now, I can't read music now barely because times changed and I didn't do it, didn't keep it up. I came back to school the next year, my French horn mouthpiece in my hand, ready to go to start the next year. And they're assigning everybody to the different class groups. And so the A and B class of grade 8 was the band kids, and the E and F classes was the group that were in drama and art. And I was in 8E, and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be in one of these classes. They put me in the wrong class. So I went up to the principal and the various people that were, you know, organizing everything, and I go, I'm in the wrong class. I'm in band. I registered for band. And they looked at their sheets and said, well, we show you were in drama last year, and we've got marks for you for drama, and computers don't make mistakes, so you're in drama. And that's what introduced me to it. And it was like, our band teacher had moved to Calgary, so there was no band teacher to vouch. No, he should be in band. It was really weird. So it was fun. We had a fun drama teacher in junior high. We didn't really do any shows, but we did skits in class and we had fun. So in high school, I took it because it was fun. And in high school, our drama teacher, the late Oris Konasiewicz, he had been a junior A hockey player, and then he went off with a scholarship for hockey, and then they found out he had a semi-pro contract, so he lost his hockey scholarship, and he qualified and got a drama scholarship. And he ended up becoming a professional actor for a number of years in the Chicago area before moving back to Edmonton. And then he became a teacher. So he was working in the evenings as a professional actor in live theater. And in the day, he was teaching theater to kids in high school. And it wasn't about, we're going to go have a little fun or we're going to do a little play once a year. It's, this is serious. I'm going to teach you everything about how to be an actor and voice and movement. And there was no playing around. It was serious work. We did a whole season of theater. And he lit a fire in my belly that has never gone out to this day. And he challenged people. And there was a number of people I know from those years that I was in high school who are professional actors today or who are to this day still very serious avocational actors. They'll never give it up. They're in theater in one way or another or in film. And that's what got me into it. And I've never looked back.
So, passion.
Passion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being shown what that is like.
And it's an amazing thing.
Yeah. When somebody has belief in you and sends you out into the world to do something that you're excited about, and you learn and you get better. When I was 36, I did My Fair Lady, my first musical. I was up in Yellowknife. It was an amazing production. Christopher Foreman directed it and built almost all the hats and dresses. He was genius designer and director. And I sent the videotape of it. Sorry, the powers that be, we made a videotape of our little amateur production. I sent it to my father, who was living in Victoria, and he phoned me. He said, "Oh my God, I've watched your tape. It was amazing. You were so good. It was like you were born to play Henry Higgins. It was just perfect. And now I understand why you love theater so much, because I went to all your shows in high school and that, and I always thought, why does he want to be an actor? You're no good at it. But I'm so proud of you." And it was like, and I realized that's the first time my dad said he was proud of me. But that's why I did it, because I had to. You'll find, everybody finds something they just have to do, whether it's beekeeping or you name it.
Well, yeah. I own the fact, like, I write books. That's what I do, right?
You have to.
I have a big ass mouth. That's why we're doing this, right? And that's the thing, right? But I learned a long time ago, I love telling stories. Yeah. I love hearing people tell them theirs. And and in this conversation, I've got a glimpse of yours, and nice. It's awesome. And it sounds like you've had a wonderful career.
You know, it's an ongoing thing, and somebody asked me once about success, like, when will you be successful? I said, I've been successful all the time, because success to me is just doing what you want to do. It doesn't matter if you've reached a certain level of financial income or recognition. None of that matters. If you're doing what you want to do in life in some way or another, and you're pursuing that, that's success.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing I kind of wish, this has been my wish this is one of the reasons I do the podcast, honestly. Canadians are some of the most talented people in the world.
Oh yeah.
And the last people to recognize it are Canadians themselves. Yeah. That's the thing. Like,
we have a lot less of that. Look, there's a star in chasing people down the street than they have in some places.
Fame, yes. Fame. See, honestly, fame's a curse. It's a curse. But that's not it. I've lived in both countries, Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
And this is the one thing they do absolutely better than us. It's not even close. They will go to us. They will go. Somebody goes up and goes, "Hey, I want to try this." It's encouraged to a degree. Here, it's like it's kind of risky, kind of this, kind of that. You got like there's a lot more of that.
When are you going to get a real job?
Yeah, there's a lot more of that here, right? And that's something that I think.
We've got a much more of a play it safe attitude, I think.
No, absolutely. Yeah. The thing is, in truth, this is why a lot of Canadians go stateside, right? This is why, right? At least in our particular fields, because it's,
well, there's just a lot more opportunity, a lot more bigger centers.
Well, that there's that, but it's also they recognize the value of it more. I'm not saying that. Like, that's the one little thing I kind of wish is, like, in my lifetime, whether I'm here or there, I come back to Canada, it's like Canadians go, "Hey, you're great. because you are great at what you do and you deserve to be recognized, not just professionally, even financially, a little bit more than what you are. And that's something I would advocate for. One, the trade-off is, yes, we don't got many people chasing after you because you played a part in a role,
and
right?
Thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah, no. Fame is a curse. Don't do this for the fame.
Yeah.
Do this because you love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? If Ryan Reynolds is walking down the street, people are going to go, there's Ryan Reynolds. But they're not going to chase him down for the most part and surround him.
Toronto and Vancouver, maybe, but not here, right?
No.
Right? But, I mean, it's a different it's a slightly different ambiance there. That's the one thing that's good. But yeah, personal note, I just look at it, it's like, yeah, man, there's so many people that are good at what they do here. Like, legit. I it's included, right? That's just like, yeah. I hope you understand this. I think we deserve more. And
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Everybody does.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm fighting for a lot of things in the background that I think everybody deserves more. Everybody deserves a basic standard of living. And
The minimum wage job should actually pay for everything. People should be working two or three.
The person that through no fault of their own or through fault of their own, it doesn't matter. The person who is in a position where they can't work still deserves that same standard of living.
Sure.
I truly believe in a universal basic income. Yes, I'm a red commie socialist. But,
I'm 50-50. No, like, legit, I'm 50-50 on it. I love the idea of it.
It costs less than running all the other programs
No. I love the idea of it.
Yeah.
I do. My only real concern is not so much the idea, but who's doing it, right? And that's the thing. Like, going back to something I said earlier, right? If every particular leader has been a mess, they'll find a way to screw this up too.
Oh, of course they will. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's an evolving thing. It's I grew up watching Star Trek, and I still do to this day, and I love the ethos of that world, and I'd like to think we're growing toward that a lot more than we're growing towards some dystopian future.
Oh no, I agree. By the way, what's your favorite Star Trek?
Yes, I really like Strange New Worlds, but it's brand new and it's great, and I've got a friend that's been on it, and another friend that does a lot of
stunt
work and prosthetic makeup work on it, and I think it's a brilliant throwback to the way the original series was told. But it's also got a real modern feel as well.
So
I like all of them. I haven't had one that I was disappointed in.
DS9 is my favorite.
DS9 was lovely.
Yeah, it's my favorite one because I think it's. I love Next Generation. Like, Next Generation's the one I grew up with. The original series has its charm. It's definitely a little dated in some spots.
Sure,
but again, for its time, it was amazing.
I like DS9. It's one location. There's people coming in and out because it's a station.
That,
so you get to see what the whole community is like rather than we're flying all over the galaxy
I think that's the most amazing. I think that's the most amazing thing about DS9. It's like, okay, if you look at like the main cast, it's really hard to top the Next Generation because that is an amazing cast.
Sure.
But if you look at the cast from the main cast, the guest cast, all that stuff, DS9 is got.
Stellar.
It's amazing, yeah. Right? All due respect to all the Star Treks that have come since before. Yeah. I don't think I've seen a cast that densely good.
I still wish Enterprise would have gotten two or three more seasons because I really liked Scott Bakula and I liked the way that was being told.
I honestly think that was a timing one. I think that was timing because I think after Voyager. They needed to give the franchise a break, but they kept going with Enterprise. I think if Enterprise had been like they had done a break and then come back with Enterprise,
yeah, another
I think
couple of years maybe.
I think it would have done better. I just think because seasons, every season one of Star Trek is always finding that voice usually. So it wasn't as crazy. I love the theme song, but season one's kind of mad. But seasons two and three are really really good, and although. It's just like, yeah, I just think that series in particular, it was timing.
Yeah.
Right? Lower Decks is kind of also a secret little, like, I enjoy it.
Lower Decks is a lovely guilty pleasure. It's funny as hell.
Yeah, it's designed to be. Like, yeah, it's not. It is.
I loved the crossover episode they did with Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
It was so good. It was brilliant.
I love the DS9 when we had Nana Visitor and Quark by Armin Shimmerman. Like, that's just, like, again, amazing show. Like, I'm going to ask an evil question. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Yes, I love them both. Yeah. I'm not that polarized. I don't have favorites. I love them both for different reasons.
No, I got you.
They're so good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Live long and prosper, my friend.
Okay, so before we wrap this bad boy up, do you have anything you like to plug? Like how people can find you? Is there a show coming up in like a month or two?
On Friday, that's on time, my face. On Friday, I open in the Peacock season with Morpheus Theater. It's a lovely little comedy, accidental, everybody dies sort of farce. It's a lot of fun. Love and jealousy and marriage, I don't know. It's a funny little show. I don't have anything else on stage coming up. I'm waiting for a film. I had a lovely principal role in a film called The Birds Who Feared Death. That was filmed about a year and a half ago, and it's probably coming out in the next 6 to 8 months from what I understand.
Okay, cool.
Tremendous, tremendous locally shot film, a great cast, and the director and writer, Sanjay Patel, who put that together, was a joy to work with, and I'm looking forward to that hitting our theaters. It's going to be a really good Alberta-based story.
That sounds fun. And how can people find you?
They can find me. I'm on Facebook, and I don't hide, so they can just look for me. But I've got a really, really weak actor website that has my reel and some voice demos, and that's just stuartbentley.me.
Okay, do you have an IMDb?
I do, and it's linked off of stuartbentley.me, or you can go to IMDb and search my name, and you'll see there's a couple of me. There's Stuart Bentley 1, who's a lovely cinematographer in England, and then I'm Stuart Bentley 2, because, you know, I should probably use my middle name to differentiate, but the cinematographer and I had chatted. Go, hey, look, another Stuart Bentley.
It happens. Yeah, I'm sure it does.
So I'm hoping one day I get to work on a film that he's the cinematographer for.
I hope can see that happening.
So
anyway, folks, thanks for listening to this chat. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And going from there, check out Stuart and any of his plays. I'll have definitely more interviews like this very, very soon.
Check out my books on Audible.
That's true. Oh, did anything come out recently that you're aware of?
The Chief Executive Operating System, if you want to listen to a great business book, or Remembering Stardust, is an amazing book.
Okay.
I highly recommend Remembering Stardust.
So those two books, check those out. And for everybody watching, everybody listening, thank you for watching, thank you for listening. Stay inspired, keep shining in the dark, and I'll see you next time.
Josh. Josh.
Want to learn how to put together a podcast? Well, you're in luck. As someone who has done over 1,000 episodes of the podcast, have won awards, and have also done shows for companies and clients, I am more than happy to teach you how it is to create a podcast. In my course, you will learn the following skills: how to put together a show, what does that actually entail, whether it's audio or video, how to interview guests, why you would actually get guests, if that is whether you do them or not regularly on the show, whether or not how to market your show, whether you're trying to make money, or even how to do some extra fun things that you never would imagine doing in a podcast. This is my course. This is how it's done. And I'm here to show you. So there, for the month of December, you will get 25% off if you register for the course. It launches for December, the week of Christmas. So definitely click on the link in the description below if you want to register.
Josh. Shush!